The views and comments expressed on the Space Show by its guests, callers, and listeners belong to them. The Space Show and its hosts serve only as a platform and are not responsible for others' comments or views. All topics discussed on the Space Show are primarily for educational purposes.
We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other thing. Not because they are easy, but
we have main engine start. 4, 3, 2, 1.
It's the Space Show with Dr. David Livingston, broadcasting to 7 continents, consistently bringing you quality news and interviews with the best and brightest minds in the new space economy. Here is the founder and host of the Space Show, the man who best articulates the vision of space commercial enterprise, Dr. David Livingston.
Good evening, listeners. Welcome to the Tuesday Night Space Show program, Tuesday Night California time. I am your host, David Livingston. Thank you very much for tuning in. Let me run through the announcements to get to our program. For those of you who would like to call in and talk with our guest tonight, Dr. Bruce Damer, it is toll-free 1-866-687-7223. Email, of course, Dr. Space, D-R-S-P-A-C-E, at thespaceshow.com. That's also our website. So visit thespaceshow.com. We have a very detailed newsletter there in the middle of the homepage. You can't miss it. And that newsletter has all of the information about the guest bios, the programs for the coming week, and it's also the only place where we have a future events section for what's coming up on the Space Show over the next several weeks. In addition, if we have to modify our schedule during the week for any reason, we do it first on the website newsletter, and I urge you to check it from time to time to make sure that the program you want to hear is the program you are going to hear. If you do tune into a program and you see that it's not what's listed in the email newsletter, for example, please check the website newsletter. We've probably explained why we had to make a last-minute change. Also on our website, thespaceshow.com, there is a store in the upper left-hand corner. You'll see it called Space Show Gear. Do check it out and visit it. Hope you find some things of interest there. There's also the guest search tool. And here there is a listing of all of our shows since the beginning in 2001. The latest shows are on top. The older shows are many, many pages back. But you can do a global search, just like you could in Word or Excel or a PDF, and you can search for your keyword or a guest to see if the guest has been on the show or which programs the guest was on. And you'll find that information, jot down the dates, and then you can go back to our Space Show search engine on our homepage, at the bottom of our homepage, and you can pull up all of those shows where that guest was a guest or where your keyword or subject matter was discussed as a significant part of the program. In addition, do remember that we are copyrighted and trademarked, and you are certainly free to download these shows and share them and pass them around on the net to people who you think will be interested in them. Please don't do anything commercial with the shows. Please don't edit the programs, even if they're for your own personal websites or use. And written transcripts are not permitted, even if they're for your own personal use. And we certainly appreciate your checking that out. Also on the website, you will see the Support the Space Show. And remember, we are a nonprofit 501c3 with one giantleapfoundation.org. And we're able to bring you all of this programming free of charge because many of you do support the show. And we certainly appreciate that. Remember, if you're a U.S. federal taxpayer, you do get a tax deduction, as we are a 501c3. The same is true for those of you in California paying California taxes. We are a California public benefit corporation. Check us out at onegiantleapfoundation.org. If you have any questions, don't hesitate to email me at drspace@thespaceshow.com. Please do remember that we are partially sponsored by the Secure World Foundation. Secure World promotes cooperative solutions for space security. For more information, visit their own website, www.swfound.org, and they are also the sponsors of our webinar series, and we thank them very much for their support. Our guest tonight is a little late, but Bruce will be here, and Bruce is going to discuss his work regarding a new architecture for sustainable spaceflight, human spaceflight. Bruce and his lead team are over at Digital Space, and for more than a decade they've been building 3D real-time simulations under contract with NASA and different aerospace companies. He has been on the show many times before, and what he has to talk with us tonight is his new program, and it's called Shepherd, S-H-E-P-H-E-R-D, which is a concept for general asteroid retrieval with a gas-filled enclosure. And he makes the case that this concentration on asteroids is a stepping stone to sustainable human spaceflight. He is a co-author on the paper I just mentioned, Shepherd, A Concept for Gentle Asteroid Retrieval with a Gas-Filled Enclosure, which recently appeared in the New Space Journal. And in the archive summary, I will put the URL for this paper so you can find it. So our guest has arrived, and we're happy that he was able to get through the traffic and to be here and is with us. So, Bruce, welcome back to the Space Show. How are you doing? And introduce us, if you will, to Shepherd and what you're talking about for sustainable human spaceflight as a stepping stone or as the real thing.
Hello, Bruce calling in.
Well, you're on the air a little late, but better late than never.
Sorry about that. I just got back in the door. Sorry.
So, listeners, we do have Bruce with us, and we've already talked about you a little bit, and but I haven't said much about what we're going to talk about tonight. I do have Doug, who sent you that email on the open lines. So, Doug, I'm going to hang up on you, and you can call back during the show if you have comments or questions for Bruce, but I'll go ahead and get off of that. And so, listeners, Dr. Bruce Damer is with us tonight, and he has been a guest on the Space Show before. We're very fortunate to have him back with us. He has Digital Space, and he's been a leader in 3D real-time simulation. And because we're starting a little bit late, we're going to talk about architectures for sustainable spaceflight and more. So, Bruce, good to talk to you. How have you been?
Wonderful to be back. I'm very sorry I was late. I was stuck in traffic, as usually happens.
Too much traffic every place. Sustainable, new architectures for sustainable spaceflight. So I'm assuming we're referring to human spaceflight, right?
Yes, and I can give your listeners the brief story on how this came to be, if you'd like.
Or... Yeah, I think that's a good starting point.
Well, you know, this is an interesting set of events. It's sort of a radical collaboration that happened about a year ago. I was at a conference in Sunnyvale, a space conference, called the Contact Conference, and for years I've been working on ways by which we could basically go out and move asteroids or icy planetesimals. You think of them as like comets, but in different orbits, to mine them in a way. But I always felt that it was not the ores, not nickel or iron or some of these metals that we should go for first. It was volatiles. It was water, ice, and carbon dioxide, methane. That these are the low-hanging fruit of sustainable spaceflight because you can make fuels and consumables out of them. So, you know, as the listeners are seeing the Europeans landing, the Rosetta mission landing on the comet, you know, we're entering this golden age of non-planetary objects. of the exploration of non-planetary objects. And I've been working on an architecture for NASA for years to enclose an asteroid in a fabric structure and put this into a report for headquarters in 2013, but nothing was coming of it. And at this conference, I met this tall, skinny guy named Peter Janiskin, and he didn't have a badge, so I said, well, let's go to lunch. But I didn't know who he was, and I showed him the graphics of this basically asteroid capture system, and he said, oh, that'll never work. You know, and of course, your heart drops, you know, all your years of work. And he gave some reasons why it wouldn't work. And then over a bowl of clam chowder, he suddenly had this thought, wait a minute, if we bring gas to the asteroid, we can make it work. We can control the asteroid with gas pressure alone. And I said, turned to him and I said, is this new? And he said, this is new. And it turns out Peter Janiskins is one of the world's leading asteroid astronomers. If something, a fireball, enters the Earth's atmosphere, his phone rings, and he goes out with his teams and picks the pieces up. And he works for the SETI Institute. So we started this collaboration. And then he brought in the world's leading balloon designer, Julian Knott, who designed the high-altitude balloon that took the fellow up who did the world record jump. And the three of us came up with this new spacecraft called, we call it Shepard, and the acronym means something. It's probably not worth reading this on the air. But Shepard is the whole design of a spacecraft that its mission is to go and basically gently envelop asteroids, whether they be icy, rocky, whatnot, introduce a gas. You know, these are asteroids that would be up to about 10 or 15 meters in an enclosure that's, you know, 20 meters across or 60 feet for us non-metric people. Introduce the gas into the sealed enclosure, which can then, through friction alone, stop the spinning and tumbling of the object, which you have to do to start controlling it. And then through gentle waves of gas coming out air beams in the back of the spacecraft within the balloon, we can waft this object and push it very, very low forces, like less than a newton worth of force. And as we push it, we take the xenon gas, in this case, through our solar electric motor on the back of the spacecraft and keep up, you know, counteract the movement of the asteroid. So we can relocate an asteroid, in this case to what NASA's target mission was, to take something of that size to lunar orbit, and so that a human crew could come and sample it for science. So that's I'll stop right there. That's the design of Shepard and what it would be designed to do.
Okay. Now, NASA announced last week that they weren't going to do a baggy type of ARM mission. They were going to carve out a boulder and use that. So where does that leave your plan?
Where that leaves our plan is very interesting, because we were part of the ARM proposals about a year ago. We did the full workup of the, at least as far as we could take the engineering estimates. And I sent you some of the drawings and computer graphics by email, just sent that. We submitted a full proposal to the BAA, and it was not funded. We were not selected, but we got high marks. One of the things we pointed out was, if you try, and this comes from Peter's expertise on these objects, putting a bag or a cable or any kind of contact with these objects is kind of close to suicide, because you're dealing with what's likely to be a consolidated rubble pile. So any forces on them whatsoever could cause them to break up. So one of the things that NASA never showed you in the ARM animations of a year and a half ago was when they close the bag down on the Neo, they don't even show you that the Neo is actually rotating. And the forces alone that are put on the asteroid could cause boulders to come off. They could cause your structure to be just torn apart and the spacecraft lost. So our entire proposal was that, no, you never touch these objects. That's why it's called Shepherd. You know, the shepherd basically takes one look at the sheep and they move. You know, sheepdogs are good at that. So the fact that NASA did not select a whole asteroid mission with a bag hard capture is good, because, you know, we just felt that was just a recipe for disaster, trying to handle one of these objects that way. The fact that they selected a boulder plucking mission, you know, is a natural evolution of sample return. The problem is, for science, that didn't meet the president's objective, and it doesn't really satisfy the science objectives, because it's only one sample. So for somebody like Peter Janiskins, who is studying, you know, the origins of the solar system, they want samples from a diverse object, a diverse rubble pile, with lots of different ages and histories. So, you know, in a sense, the Shepherd design now sort of stands alone, because it's the only proposed design that can do this kind of a mission that probably has the safety profile. It's unproven technology, but it has really good heritage. We've got Robert Bigelow's Genesis inflatables. You know, we have all the way back, and you probably remember Echo 1.
Right, of course.
So inflatables in space lasting for long periods of time, you know, it has good heritage.
So, but how do you get your project implemented? I guess that's the question. From what I read, number one, ARM is not well supported and probably won't get funded anyway. But where do you go with this? Can this be a private sector project, or does it have to be something to do with government, either public, private, or government only?
Last June, when the ARM selections came down and we were not selected, the group of us met at the New Space Conference in Sunnyvale, I think it was at San Jose, and we decided that we kind of had thought that NASA might not grok a design this radical, and we felt that we would like to go public with this, that we would like to give this concept and the full design just away to the community, and that New Space was strong enough to potentially pick it up and run with it. So, for example, if Elon Musk or anyone is looking at an architecture for going to Mars, you know, you couldn't run a Tesla Roadster more than a day unless you had a charging station, just as you couldn't run, you know, your gasoline roadster without a refueling station. So for anybody who is looking at taking human crews to Mars, it just makes sense to obtain and process and deliver returned fuel supplies to Mars orbit. And I know that Mars Society and many other groups have looked at processing return fuels from the Mars atmosphere on the surface, but that's fraught with problems. That's industrial scale processes with a lander that's already very large. You have dust in the environment. You have all these other problems. So you're already kind of doing a large risky mission in order to create a return capability. And that large risky mission is teleoperated. So it would seem to make sense, and I sent you the mission diagrams, David, that show the various elements. It would seem to make sense that if you can capture fuels in space, process them, and have them available at waypoints, you can create a lower cost, lower risk, more sustainable spaceflight architecture
So you think a private sector company or a combination of them might pick this up and do it?
We think so. It could come down to a demonstration project for this, because you have to kind of prove this on your early spirals. A demonstration project on this could be flown in low Earth orbit, you know, like a Genesis launch. But it's definitely a different kind of a structure that has to deploy and self-seal. But you could say, for instance, do a project that would envelop and control and change the orbit of a discontinued communication satellite, for example. Bring it into low Earth orbit gently and then reveal it. You could bring some object released from the space station back to the ISS, you know, on a 2-month or 1-year type fetch mission. So you can do demonstrations of this. And then gradually through the spirals, go out further, obtain rocky objects, and then your big mission is to go, you know, into the correct distances, you know, past the orbit of Mars. You're going to look for your first volatiles-rich planetesimal. So that would be the concept of gradual development.
I have a couple of emails that have come in for you. So one is a comment from Doug in Southern California. NASA's ARM video shows the bagging craft first matching the rotation of the asteroid before bagging it. After bagging it, it then despins the asteroid. So that's his comment. Whether you want to comment on that or not, it's up to you.
I think that, you know, I'm certainly not an expert in these objects, but my colleagues, when they look at that, their comment is, you've got something that has no internal, we don't have geostructural knowledge about it, and you're putting these forces on it in any way, shape, or being. You're putting a lot of force on that, and you're putting force on your fabric and your enclosure, and you just will have no way of knowing what it's going to do. Peter tells me that they know the breakup forces of some of these asteroids by the fact of when they break up in the upper atmosphere, you know.
Uh-huh.
So they, but we just don't know. So why we designed and proposed Shepard was that we don't have to know the geotechnical properties in advance, and we don't even have to know, doesn't really matter the size of the object, because we're handling it with forces that are so low that it's not a danger to the spacecraft. And the detumbling or the despinning, because these things aren't just spinning on an axis, they're also tumbling for the most part as well. And they could weigh up to 500 or 1,000 tons. That's a lot larger than your spacecraft.
He has another actual question. Your paper, and this was published in New Space, right?
Yes.
Is it available to the public to read?
It is, yeah. It's on. I can send you the link.
Send me the link, and I'll put it in the archives of the
definitely,
show.
Definitely, yep.
Okay, so your paper seems to try hard to preserve the bagged asteroid in as pristine a condition as possible for scientific purposes, but later, for mining purposes, it might be the most valuable part of the asteroid, such as pure water, may represent only a portion of it. So could your idea be used to extract the most valuable volatile, and so only having to bring back a portion of it?
Well, the volatile's mission, which we call Shepard Fuel, we have like classification. The Shepard Science Sampling Mission is really just for science. It's just to do that basically geological, if you would use the incorrect term, sampling, global sampling of the object. For the actual volatiles Shepard fuel mission, we would want to go to something that was high volatile, a high proportion of volatiles if we could, because the whole point is to capture, say, the water. And the water would be, just to give your listeners and this very good questioner a little bit of detail, once you have enclosed say, an icy planetesimal, you can control the internal temperature. Now, it may be already sending out some jets, but you can heat the interior by rotating the tent structure around so that sunward you have a highly absorptive surface and gradually collect the solar energy to heat the interior. You also have, you know, electric, you know, have solar blankets for power generation. But that interior, you could control that very, very finely. So as volatiles start coming off, you don't want them to come off too fast because they'll create jets that could tear your structure apart. But then you collect those volatiles, you pump them through a cold and hot plate system to condense them, and then you fill tanks on the tanker section, which is the main body of the spacecraft. So once you've filled your tanks, and you're talking, you know, could you produce 500 tons of sort of fractioned volatiles, include carbon dioxide, methane, all the things that we know roughly are in these objects. You fill your tank, and then you could simply release the object, you know, to space so that you didn't have to deal with all the rocky elements. And there may be materials that have come off the object that are floating freely, and you just want to sort of get away from that. So once you've filled your tanks, you release the object, and then you use electrolysis to produce your oxidant. This is all, you know, this is mining, in a sense, without ever grinding anything up, without smelting. And then you have propellant, and then you move the entire tanker block to where you need it. So that's the Shepard fuel scenario. So it's definitely not a science sampling, although certainly science could be done, but you're really just trying to capture as much of that material as you can.
You have another email from Claire, who is in Boston. And Claire says, many of us are not supportive of the ARM mission, regardless of whether they're collecting a boulder or bagging the asteroid. We believe that there is a better use for tight budgetary money, meaning let's go back to the moon or let's go to Mars, but at the ARM mission does not inspire us, and many of us think it has little value. Why do you justify the ARM mission, whether it's with your method or another method? Why is it so important to do an asteroid capture mission?
Well, you know, there's many pros and cons for the ARM. The pros is it's really excellent science, and it's the next science we need to do in spaceflight to get these very pristine, very old objects. And many nations are doing that, you know, the Japanese, of course, and we have OSIRIS-REx soon. And so the science is just excellent. Whether you need to involve human astronauts and a lot of costs to actually do the geology when it's delivered to lunar orbit, that's a really big question. You know, and there's arguments against that that are pretty strong. What we're doing is basically saying, here's a design that may be good for science, but it is also good for commercial spaceflight beyond an ARM. Because, you know, let's face it, if we can't lower the costs of all of these missions, if we're lifting, I don't know if you know it, David, but the cost of lifting a liter of water to the space station, you know.
No, I don't know off the top of my head, but it's pretty costly.
It's very costly. Well, this goes back to a conversation that I had with a friend of mine, Brad Blair, who you may have met.
Yeah, he's been on the show many times. He's a good friend.
And 10 years ago, Brad and I were standing by Hangar 1 at NASA Ames, and we were talking about lunar mining. You know, and for me, I come from a mining family in Canada. You know, my brother works in an open pit mine. You know, he has a 300-ton haul truck. It's not his, but he drives it around, and the crane and the smelter and the crusher and all that stuff. I grew up around mines. Our house would shake when they would blast the bench. And I can tell you that to the very concept for him of us having some kind of robot miner attached to a space rock in those temperatures, you know, and in those conditions, he basically asked me the question, are you crazy? One. And two, where is all the related technology you need to keep hard rock mining equipment working? So for him, and I guess for me, it was a no-go. Mining on the moon, mining on an asteroid in that traditional sense of smelting materials. So here we are standing, Brad Blair and I, one night at Ames, and I noticed a light flashing on Hangar 1, which, of course, it has to because it's right on an active taxiway. It's a pretty tall building. And I said, it suddenly occurred to me, and I said to Brad, what if that flashing light was a comet captured in the Earth-Moon system that was just going around, it was going to burn itself off? And Brad turned to me and said, that would be the most valuable real estate, space real estate in the solar system. Every space-faring nation would be after to try to control that. And I said, well, why? And he said, because you'd have suddenly in orbit thousands of tons of useful material that would lower the cost of going further out, that would provide all these useful things that we need in space. So I said, my answer to Brad was, well, why don't we learn how to go and get those things? So that was the inspiration of this idea.
Do you think do you have a timeline for trying to put your concept in motion?
Well, what I'm doing, David, is on April 24th, I'm doing a presentation at TEDx Santa Cruz. You know, the local TED event.
Uh huh.
So that's where I'm going to put it out in 9 minutes or less.
Is that how much time they give you?
That's how much time. And after that, we've got submissions into several space conferences. We have we have several space news organizations, which I can't name right now, that are going to be running stories about the concept. And I did this all back in 2007. I don't know if you remember the human asteroid mission designs that we put out.
Uh-huh.
And that was during the Bush moon years. And I was working with a team that was developing for Mike Griffin. You know, Mike Griffin wanted to say, can we take Constellation hardware, you know, which includes the current Orion, can we take it some other place than the moon? And so this headquarters civil servant team, some members came here, and we actually designed, and I did the design of basically the docking and EVA ops and configuration of the spacecraft. And this was so controversial at the time that it was embargoed. And so because, you know, there was an objective that the current administration had. So come July of 2007, Pete Warden at NASA Ames said, you can go public. You're not a civil servant. You can't be fired. Because you know, Pete had been fired already as a civil servant and didn't want to be fired again. So I did, and it went. I basically did a presentation at Industrial Light and Magic as the opener in San Francisco to an auditorium of animators. And then we did another public talk, and then all across the news wires, whether it be space.com or CNET or, you know, places like that, and then on the cover of Popular Science, this mission design and this graphics appeared. And lo and behold, it was really the only, as far as we knew, you know, early but qualified attempt at saying, what do you do when you get a spacecraft to an asteroid that's big enough for human EVA ops, and what would it look like? So that went out. You know, Obama was elected. They, you know, rejiggered the previous administration's plans to go to the moon, looked around for a new objective, and asteroids became it. And our effort was one of those things that helped steer it. And I found out this was confirmed because the young Italian student who came up with the ARM. I don't know if you remember his name. He was cited as being the author of the ARM. I called him up last March to see if he'd join our proposing team. And he said, oh, I'm back in Italy and I've already moved on to something else. But yes, I saw your Popular Science cover in 2007. And that's when I started thinking, wouldn't it be better to bring the asteroid closer in? And that's where the ARM came from. And he said, I also had a Popular Science cover. So I said to him, you and I are the two people who had Popular Science covers on asteroid mission designs, you know, that never got supported, you know, for NASA. That was really funny that these two crazy guys, me and him, were somehow steering NASA in a kind of a indirect way.
Right before the show tonight, you sent me a group of images. Are these on a website someplace for listeners to look at?
They're not yet public, so those will be presented in my TEDx talk. So
okay.
Those are just absolutely fresh out of the renderer. And so they're just for you as talking points.
Okay. Too bad, because I'm sure the listeners would find them really valuable. But
we're kind of on an embargo on that until everything's done toward the end of April.
How big? I mean, you said maybe the encasing would be 60 feet. Is that the largest that you could try to encase in your gas envelope? Is to have your envelope or your cover be 60 feet across, or could you do something larger?
You could do much larger. So, for example, for the Shepard fuel variant, we would have something much bigger because we're going to actually be getting gases from the object, not just introducing gas to de-spin it. So our reference for that is about 120 feet. And really, it's only limited by the stowage and mass capacities of your stowage bay of your material. You know, you just have to go up a booster class. These craft are not huge. I mean, they're not, they're not something that needs to be launched like Skylab, that enormity.
Okay. I'm going to take a break in a few minutes, but I have another listener question for you, okay?
Yep.
This is Bob in San Diego, California. And Bob said, first of all, is there any way that people can see your coming TED Talk? And two, will you be planning to speak at any upcoming conferences, and where will they be in case some of us can get to them and hear your talk and ask you questions?
Yes, the TED Talk, April 24th in Santa Cruz, tickets are selling now if you're in the area, should be online. Usually they take about a month in the past to get them online at TEDx. So sometime, I would assume, by the end of May. And we have also applied for several conferences. I'm not sure which ones right now. Some of the team members we had a poster at a conference in Houston in January. That was our first conference presentation. But I can certainly, we can send the link to the paper.
Okay.
Put it on the space show.
What about the upcoming Space Access Conference in Phoenix? Are you planning to be there?
I hadn't planned on being there. Things are just too crazy with this to do this TEDx event. But hopefully after that, I mean, I've basically got my whole rest of the year available to go out on the road. Myself, Peter, and Julian, each one of us covering it from our own perspectives.
What is the interest of SETI, or is it just the interest of Peter himself?
You know, that's a very good question. I think certainly for the science value, which is, you know, if this works, and it's still an if, it's a really, you know, significant thing to be able to move objects like this for science in the solar system, and to not, you know, one of the problems that Peter pointed out with the the hard grab bag capture, even if it worked, you end up with a lot of dislocation of the object and a loss of surface, that surface material. You end up with the, you know, kind of a an object that's not in pristine shape. So to have an object that's in pristine shape that's from the time of the formation of the Earth is incredibly valuable to science, including the other field that I work in, which is in origin of life biochemistry, because that was the material that was falling on the Earth in the early Archean. That was the material that was potentially, you know, contained our amino acids and our building blocks for lipids that we origin of life researchers would love to have our hands on.
Why xenon gas?
Xenon gas is a good candidate because it's very inert, and because if you're using a solar electric propulsion, just like, you know, many of the outer solar system missions are using, you know, the famous ion drives, that is what you're going to be using for your propulsion. So if you need 6 or 8 tons of it, you use some of it for your gas management, and you're using the same gas for thrust.
Okay. And then I did read your paper that you sent me, and thank you for sending it to me. So you do point out that there is still a risk that the asteroid is going to disintegrate, right?
Yeah.
So... And then, okay, you throw your hands up in the air and you try again. Why would it disintegrate with your method?
The asteroid could, well, for example, there really isn't a way that you're going to be putting forces on it that could disintegrate the whole structure. But objects could still come off. So an object, an asteroid that's never had an atmosphere around it suddenly has a 1/10 Earth atmosphere of xenon, and it's rotating, and you have your cameras and your lights on it, material may come off the surface. Dust certainly will. There will be a lot of dust in the enclosure. But if a large object comes off, and all of this is done in very, very slow motion, you're doing these things, the animations that we have made are sort of, they're probably sped up 100 times just to get the point across. There may come a point at which you say, there's too many objects in the enclosure, let's reopen the enclosure, back away, and let this material dissipate to space, and then re-enclose the same object once that material has cleared the area. Kind of like when you have a stage separation. You know, you want to be away from anything that, your last stage separation. From bolts and things like that that may be floating around. So I think that, you know, at all times, safety to the structure is your primary concern. But you can manage it because you're doing things with very, very low velocity changes and very, very low pressure.
You got a message from a latecomer to the show, Luis, who's in Venezuela. I'll read it, although we've already been talking about this stuff. Sorry I tuned in late. Is there some material that Dr. Damard's Shepard concept talks about? So, Luis, he has a paper that he co-authored with several other people, and he is going to provide me with the URL for where that paper is, and I'll put it in the archive summary of the show, and you can read his paper online. And that's really the only material and information that's available until after your TED Talk, correct?
That's correct, yeah. The space show is getting a real early look at this.
Okay. So, Luis, you'll have to wait. I don't know how to get it to you sooner than that in time for you to maybe go through it and ask questions for the show, but it will be available, and you'll get it when I archive the show, which will probably be first thing tomorrow morning. Before I take the break, I also noticed that one of your authors is another space show guest who's been on 3 or 4 times, although I haven't talked to her in a couple of years. But I know Constance Adams as a life support specialist and expert. So where does Constance fit in with this?
Constance fit in years ago. We did work with Constance on basically medical training aboard ISS, and we did simulations of that kind of thing.
Uh-huh.
But it turns out she had an earlier career with the Transhab.
Right, I remember that.
So Transhab was the concept of an inflatable that would be part of the space station. And, of course, as we know now, Robert Bigelow actually now has an agreement and to put an inflatable, I think it's called the Beam Module.
Right, for the ISS.
For ISS. So, you know, Constance had good background. She's also a space architect. She's one of the few actual practicing space architects.
Yeah, and she's an expert on closed life support and all of it. She's really quite a brilliant lady.
Absolutely, yeah.
A great person to know, in addition. I should call her and bring her back to the show. In fact, this reminds me to get back in touch with her. She's always a great space show guest. We're at the top of the hour, listeners. I'm going to take a pause for a couple of minutes, and we'll be back in 3 minutes with Dr. Bruce Damer and more on this topic. You can give us a call, 1-866-687-7223. Remember, no call screener. I do answer the phone during the break, and hopefully you'll give us a call. Email, continue using Dr. Space, DrSpace, at thespaceshow.com. Back in 3 minutes.
The Space Show thanks its listeners for their generous support. The Space Show now joins forces with the One Giant Leap Foundation to further advance space education and the establishment of a spacefaring society and culture in America and the world. One Giant Leap Foundation is a tax-exempt organization with the purpose of advancing space education and development along with the Space Show. Your support of the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation helps get the word out as to why space is so essential and important to us all. So join with us by going to www.thespaceshow.com and clicking on the Support the Space Show button. Your contribution will help the Space Show and One Giant Leap Foundation in continuing its work and bringing you the programming you want free of charge on a continued basis. And remember, your gift to the Space Show is tax deductible.
I'm Dr. David Livingston, creator and host of The Space Show, and I would like to share my vision with you for not only this radio program, but for space development. Space should be like any other place we choose to visit, work in, or call our home. It should be just another destination, like Tahiti, Hawaii, or any place available to us right now on Earth. When this vision becomes reality, we will be spacefaring in our culture, our economy, our society, and in our lives. Our world will be vastly improved by countless space-related benefits, transforming our lives both in space and right here on Earth. And the Space Show is helping to make this vision a global reality. And welcome back, listeners. This is part two of our Tuesday evening Space Show program. We're talking to Dr. Bruce Damer. We're talking about his Shepherd concept, his and others, a concept for gentle asteroid retrieval using a gas-filled enclosure, which is really quite different, as he's been explaining it, from the NASA ARM, more conventional baggy method of capturing an asteroid. Bruce, during the break, you mentioned a couple of other areas that sounded very interesting, like mineral extraction in the Shepherd mining version. Tell the listeners about this.
Yeah, during a meeting last summer with our space mining experts, one of them, having seen our design and seen the graphics, said, "Oh, wait a minute. Because you have gas, you could use the MOND process." And I said, "Well, what is the MOND process?" And he said it was a invention by a fellow named MOND in the 1890s, where introducing carbon monoxide gas with a chunk of nickel, the carbon monoxide gas reacts with the nickel and pulls the atoms off and plates or electro deposits them at where the electric field is going in, you know, the cathode. And whatever shape of object you place there, and it's called a mandrel, you get a precision part made. And since that time, I went to visit somebody who does this, and he looked at the design, and he said, yes, you could make multi-ton, large precision parts, struts, cylinders, you know, with, if you can extract from these high nickel iron asteroid objects, you could make them in space. So you electrodeposit them after, you know, maybe weeks or months. You know, we haven't done the math on this. It's a notional concept, as NASA would use that term. But it's a possibility that beyond the International Space Station, we could look at building a station that had part of it made from materials from space. If we can bring a nickel iron asteroid into the equation using gas enclosure and then using carbon monoxide.
Could you do 3D printing with any of this somehow?
Well, in effect, David, you've hit the nail on the proverbial head. This is a form of 3D printing on a large scale in the vacuum, in zero-G, in microgravity. So Shepard Miner, the mining variation of Shepard, is 3D printing.
But without a printer, right? It's using a similar process.
Using a similar process because individual molecules or ions are being drawn to coat an object. So, and this is a 120-year-old process. And in fact, electroplating, which is done in liquid, is, you know, used everywhere. Your cell phone probably has been electroplated through liquid. But this would be using gas instead. And all without hard rock mining, all without smelting and processing, which I think is just not viable in space. Not in the immediate future.
Are you seeing any of the commercially created asteroid mining companies talking about any of this, or do they not know it yet, or is it dependent upon your big announcements coming up?
I think it's going to be dependent upon the announcement. I think that one or two of them may have gotten a look at it through some of the media sources that we're working with right now. But it's very, very preliminary. So really, it's you know, what we're hoping is in the next 6 weeks, everyone will have a look at it and be able to critique it and peer review it. And, you know, frankly, Peter, myself, and Julian decided we're just open sourcing this because we're scientists and we're explorers, and we can't mount the enterprises necessary to do this. But we believe the idea is valuable enough to give it away to the industry.
So you're making this totally open source?
Totally open source. So for over a year now, we've been doing engineering workups, animations, you know, hundreds and hundreds of pages of drawings, working with our team, doing the paper, doing the proposal to NASA, so it's all going to just be open sourced.
Well, that means that it could also be taken in a foreign country, right?
It could be. I mean, that's the whole idea of open sourcing. But I have a feeling the people that are able to act upon this, it's the new space entrepreneurs that are right here in the U.S. They're the closest. You know, you talked about Robert Bigelow.
Uh-huh.
We talked about, and we may have mentioned Elon Musk, who, you know, certainly understands the value of refueling stations or recharging stations.
So one always tends to think, well, if this is really going to go anywhere, you know, clearly NASA's the game player, but it doesn't sound to me like NASA has much interest in it. Is that correct?
It's possible. You know, the problem with NASA is time horizons. You know, that a project gets started and then it gets kiboshed a year later, and a lot of good thinking goes by the wayside. You know, NASA's, if you wanted to pick NASA as a development partner, I don't know how you could get a business off the ground. I mean, this is in a sense why they started COTS, you know, commercial off the shelf.
Right.
And it was brilliant. It's a brilliant move because it generated all these private enterprises that have contracts. It's like when the U.S. government decided to hire the nascent airlines in the 1920s to start delivering mail. You know, they kick-started the private airline industry. So that's a really good move that NASA did.
Have you had any interest shown from other space agencies from other countries?
No one's really seen this. It's really that new.
Well, but I mean, your paper has been out. I don't know when it was published.
I think about 10 days ago, maybe.
Oh, so this, even in the New Space Journal, this is relatively new paper.
It's totally new, and while we've been talking about it privately to experts just to get peer review, this is really the launch period of this idea. And there's one more variant that your listeners might want to know about.
Uh-huh.
It turns out, and this came from my original reason for doing all this. NASA invited me in 2013 to work up an architecture for trying to see if biological agents could live on, you know, asteroids. And I did a whole design, and that's what started this bad gas enclosure process. So I returned to that and said, what if instead of boiling all the volatiles off or sublimating the volatiles off for concentration in your tanks, what if you decided to leave, say, the icy planetesimal, which has now become a water sphere, leave it in the water phase? Well, and have the appropriate atmosphere around it. Well, could you not, and this is even more notional than the minor, but could you not then introduce your biological agent and generate, you know, basically farming and fishing using this enclosure, very much like one of those glass spheres that has a complete ecosystem in it that you can buy, you know.
Right.
As long as you've got sunlight going in, it'll go on forever. So could you not do this in space with some shepherd biological variant, and therefore have this thing parked near your colony habitat in orbit that was partly built by Shep Minor and supplied by the fuel version of Shep with lots of water and all those other consumables? Could you then not start supplying foodstuffs to crew? And you're really, if that would work, you're getting close to a really fully sustainable system.
So when you say fully sustainable, are you talking about a closed life support system?
Yes, and the fact that apart from certain parts, I mean, I think microelectronics and all those things, it's going to take a long time before we're producing them anywhere but the surface of the Earth. But certainly, you know, there's been many proposals and much work done on projects like Biosphere 2 25 years ago. But many projects conceived of to grow foodstuffs and provide them to crews on stations. But if you simply had this globule that was maintained by gas, managed by gas, that was inoculated with consumable, you know, biological, productive foodstuffs, and we can probably list them. I'm not an expert in this. You might have a very big reservoir to draw from. And you're just using liquid phase of water, which is what the Earth is. So you're creating, in effect, a biosphere.
Jim is in Denver, Colorado, and I don't know why we're getting emails. Listeners, I can't believe you're at work. But anyway, 1-866-687-7223 is our toll-free number. Jim is in Denver, and he said, I don't know how familiar you are with the Mars One project or whether you have any respect for it or not, but part of their issues are greenhouses on Mars and other ways of trying to provide food for the Mars colonies that they're bringing to Mars, and some of that has been criticized by others looking into the Mars plan. Do you see any application for what you're talking about on a human spaceflight mission to Mars or a settlement effort on the surface of Mars?
That's a very, very good question, and help us sort of round out the show. In fact, Gerry O'Neill, I mean, if your listeners remember Gerard O'Neill.
Yeah, we all know who he is.
We all know who he is. Uh-huh. And one of the things that Gerry O'Neill said, I think in the 70s, was that a planetary surface may not be the best place to start civilization or colonies outside the Earth. It's fraught with problems. So, you know, the surface of Mars is fraught with problems, certainly the lunar surface is. So my contention here is that if we can, as much as possible, if we can build capability in space, we can supply those bases or initial, you know, attempts at creating human presence, we can supply them from orbit. So in our Mars ship design, and I've just sent that to you, I sent that to you earlier, David, the concept of that is when the ship gets to Mars orbit, an identical tanker unit that has the fuel and consumables for return journey is swapped out with the empty that the Mars ship has so that they are assured of return fuel and return consumables. And then they can fuel their lander to go down multiple times to the surface and, you know, do 4, 5, 6 sorties. So that actually evolves because when you'd finally decide we're going to build a large station around Mars from space resources, and you build a bio, you have a Shepard bio, you have Shepard fuel, and you have the Shepard miner, then you could look at down at the surface and say, let's build a research station just like we have in Antarctica, and but we can supply it from outside. We can supply it from orbit. So if we run into trouble, nobody's in trouble down there. They're not dealing with the dust, the radiation. You're dealing in a much more controlled environment from orbit. So you could viably attempt to do the surface habitation thing, which we have, you know, 100 years or 70 years of experience in Antarctica now. But we still have to resupply those bases.
So when he wants to know, when the emailer wants to know the applicability, highly applicable.
Very applicable.
Even for a lunar settlement.
Even for lunar. It's totally universal. I mean, even looking at outer solar system, you know, there you're dealing with different power generation requirements, but really it's the same kind of thing. So as you extend your reach, you're using identical hardware, identical technology, because it's all about the use of space resources and the use of a simple innovation in Shepard, which is placing an atmosphere around objects, which is basically what the Earth is, and creating a sustainable network. And as you go to the outer solar system, you're looking at way stations and having lots of these systems in place. There will be a commodities market. So somebody buys a futures contract on delivery of such and such a fuel block, you know, and then these missions can actually happen, and you'll end up with the things we read about in science fiction. And in my TEDx talk, I'm going to bring up Chesley Bonestell's wonderful artwork for the Von Braun Collier's magazine articles that, of course, you, David, you probably read when you were younger.
Yeah, of course.
And, you know, what's interesting about all that is Von Braun and, you know, I think it was Willie Ley, the other authors of these articles, kind of assumed that we were going to be doing that. If you look at their Mars scenario, they have all these tankers in the orbit of Mars with great big tanks. So I'll be bringing this up on screen and saying, look at this vision from 1953-54, you know, before Sputnik.
Full circle. Are your lead people Peter, Julian, and you, among the people whose names are on this paper, the three of you are running with it?
We're running with it, and, you know, each from our own design and experience perspective, but we're the three musketeers of this thing.
So my reason for asking that, especially if your visuals are on a website someplace, it would be great after your TED Talk and in conjunction with the three of you if I brought the three of you on as a space show webinar.
Yeah, I think
to talk about this and to show the video or show the pictures and to let people have it. So we use analog technology, unfortunately, but when you don't have the money for digital, you do what you can do, right?
You do what you can do.
So that's why I said if the visuals are on a website rather than us having to stream the visuals, because if we stream it in analog, it'll be crappy.
Yeah.
So, but if it's on a website, then they can access it on their computers and it'll be fine.
Yeah.
But I think the three of you doing a webinar on this with the visuals would be fabulous.
That's exactly, David, that's exactly what this whole launch is about. So I'm sure that I could arrange that.
Okay. So I'm going to make a note to send you some, webinar dates and let you bring it up to the others. Now, I don't know either Julian or Peter. As I said, the ones I know are Constance and Brad, but they don't seem to be running with it like the other two.
So. Yeah, we're the driving force. And
yeah, right.
By the time we do our webinar, there will be a number of stories on well-known space media outlets as well, so that we can refer everyone to those.
Excellent. So I usually do the webinars on Sunday afternoon, and they're 2 hours. All you need is a webcam on a laptop, and the rest is fine. Here, you've got a caller coming in just here in the nick of time for the show. Hang on.
Wonderful.
Good evening, caller. Who are you? Where are you?
This is Tim from Huntsville.
Okay.
Yeah, I just sent you a link to a website called neofuel.com. It's a proposal to extract water ice from short period comets and to fuel nuclear or solar thermal spacecraft.
Okay.
I was wondering how feasible do you think that would be? Is there any short-period comets we can actually go to, and how much water you could actually extract from it? Because if I recall correctly, even the long-period comets, they're kind of considered dirty snowballs.
Yeah. In fact, I looked at that site, and I defer to Peter Janiskins, who basically said that comets are, in tough orbits to do the delta V thing, and that we ought to be looking for planetesimals or asteroids much more accessible that have a high volatiles content. I remember 3-4 years ago we had those pictures come in that showed what seemed to be an asteroid with jets coming out of it, and somebody created a new classification. They called it a wet NEO, or a wet asteroid. So there seems to be a gradation. And it really comes down to the experts in where these things are located. The challenge is going to be, locating a population, doing your reconnaissance mission, and then before you do your capture mission, because you've got to locate good targets.
Yeah, I think that is a big issue. I mean, there are a large population of asteroids with a lot of volatiles, but they're out in the main asteroid belt where the sunlight isn't as powerful. There isn't as intense, so the volatiles aren't being evaporated off.
Correct.
And that's the thing I really wondered about, because how many these carbonaceous chondrites are accessible that's in near-Earth orbit versus how many of them are stony asteroids or the nickel-iron asteroids?
Correct. That is part of the science that needs to be done, and I'm assuming that for these higher volatiles, that we're going to be going out certainly past the orbit of Mars. We're going to be, maybe not going quite the distance that Rosetta went, but it's somewhere in there, and we need surveys. And my friends in NASA are always putting up their hands for IR surveys, that will really help us open this potential frontier.
Tim?
Yes?
The site you sent me is by Anthony Zuperl, Dr. Zuperl. And I don't know if you know him or not, but I have sent him a couple of invitations to be a space show guest, and I've never, ever received a reply from him. So if you know him, I would appreciate an assist.
Oh, I'm afraid I don't know him. I've never had any correspondence with him.
Okay, well, just a thought. And that other gentleman, I've not heard from, the one you mentioned yesterday to me. So, at the university, but I have asked Dr. Zuperl a couple of times by email to be a guest on the show through this website. I found an email address for him, but so if anyone out there does know him, an assist would be appreciated. I think he'd be an interesting guest.
I know one other person I really wish you had on as a guest, but it's too late now because he's passed away a few years ago.
Well,
that was Robert Drax. Had you ever had him on as a guest?
No, and you know, I've met him at conferences, and he couldn't. In the time I've been doing the space show, it would have been really difficult to have him do a space show program. So I've met him at AIAA conferences and in the later years of his life, and I think doing an hour or a 90-minute, you know, radio show without someone there with him probably would have been hard because he was up there in his years.
Oh, okay, I understand.
But I heard him talk a few times at AIAA, and you know, he was very interesting, and you could tell he was really up there in years. And I got to hand it to him. If all of us are that active and that strong when we're in our, I guess when we're in our 90s, because he was in his 90s, I believe, you know, we'd be pretty happy.
Yeah. I think he was middle-aged back in the 50s and 60s.
Yeah, but the show didn't exist back then.
True. Yeah.
Did you know?
I was just commenting on how old he was.
Yeah, no, he's a very interesting guy, and as I said, I got to meet him and hear him a couple of times at AIAA conferences, and I feel privileged to have been able to hear him that way. Just like having what's his name on for the nuclear guy who called the show that time. I can't have terrible senior moments, but. Bruce, going back, anything else for you, Tim?
I wanted to make a suggestion about delivering asteroids to low Earth orbit. One thing you could do to make it safer is to probably, pulverize the asteroid so that there's that the pieces are too small to survive reentry.
One of the things Peter points out is we're bringing, we would be bringing asteroids quite small, actually smaller than the ones that he typically is called out to pick up, small pieces of. So, you know, you're absolutely right. And if you're bringing something that's high in volatiles, it's going to be even less of an impact. In general, you wouldn't be handling large objects because you just can't. So a lot of small objects that are of no danger to anyone in very, very gentle and managed orbits that are, these orbits are changed so slowly that it would take years for somebody to try to make a bullseye out and do anything destructive with it.
Oh, one more question I have to ask. What size asteroid would you have to have to build a O'Neill colony, since you mentioned Gerard O'Neill?
Yes. Well, Jerry, if you're out there, you'd probably need quite a few asteroids. You're doing everything by tonnage, so thousands of tons brought in. I think by the time we're building an O'Neill colony, if we get there, we're going to have vastly bigger technologies. I think that Shepard may be a way to kickstart the whole thing, and then we'll end up with very, very large structures that can piggyback on the building of even larger structures. And that is where my imagination is unable to go at the moment.
Okay, Tim, is that it?
That's it.
Thank you for your call. Bruce, any concluding comments, pearls of wisdom, takeaways you want us to hold on to?
I think that for us, you know, for me being back in 1978 when I started in high school and I started drawing all these space architectures and sending them off to Johnson Space Center and whatnot and getting letters back, encouraging letters, this is before shuttle, I'm very excited. I mean, this has been 35 years of dreaming and doing simulation and modeling for NASA for 12 years and then finally meeting the right people that have the right skills. It's a really interesting radical collaboration that has produced what we think is a new invention, and it's a new invention worth trying out, even on a small scale in low Earth orbit.
Well, I look forward to following it with you, and we'll look forward to doing that webinar I talked about, and hopefully your other partners will want to do it as well too. And I'm glad we finally caught up with you tonight, and we'll look for the TED Talk and for more of what you're doing on this project. Do send me the URL, because a couple of people have asked me for it already on the show tonight.
Will do.
And we'll talk soon.
Yes, indeed, Dave. It's a pleasure to be back on the Space Show.
Thank you, Bruce. And listeners, that's it. Back on Friday with our Space Show program. Tomorrow night, Dr. Ben Arroyo is talking about Mars rather than Moon. So you can listen to John Batchelor live, or you can listen to the archive when I have that up Thursday morning. And then no show on Sunday because it's Easter Sunday. Everyone have a great week. Thank you for the Space Show, and thanks for Bruce for joining us tonight.
Well, welcome.
Goodbye, everyone.